You're tuned in to the Health After 30 podcast. And if you experience anxiety and you find it kind of debilitating, this episode is going to help you listen to your anxiety and perhaps even change it into a super.
Hey, I'm Alana Bonneman, naturopath and holistic nutritionist. This podcast is dedicated to reclaiming your health by harnessing yourself as your biggest asset. Get ready, because this is where we stand up for your body's ability to heal, go against outdated norms, and say yes to change. Creating true and lasting success, all from the inside out. Thank you so much for being here. This is the Health After 30 podcast, and let's get started.
Hello, friends, and welcome back to another episode of the Health After 30 podcast. It's Alana Bonneman here with you, and today I am joined with Sharda Kripes. She's a coach, certified yoga teacher, and the creator of Decoding Anxiety. She talks about the skills that we were never taught when we should deal with anxiety. So that is what the episode is about today, how we can perhaps acknowledge anxiety and what we can do or what we can feel to try and understand what it is that our body is telling us and how we can perhaps adapt our life to our situation rather than feeling like we're not fitting in or not doing things right because of the way in which we react to the world. I hope you enjoy today's episode. If you enjoy this one or any other one, please feel free to leave a review or a rating. Thank you so much for being here. I'm Alana Bonneman, and let's get into today's episode. Hello, friends, and welcome back to another episode of The Health After 30. Today, I'm joined with Sharda Kripes. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Alana. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm also really looking forward to today's topic because it's something that I feel that a lot of us as women experience. Do you want to share with us what we're going to learn in today's episode?
Definitely. So I think we're going to chat a lot about advocating for our own health, with ourselves, with the medical system, with the community around us, just through my journey and with so many that I've interviewed over the years. I think we've been taught to just accept that having these uncomfortable symptoms or being, you know, tired, fatigued, having chronic worry is just a part of daily life. And, you know, oftentimes, you know, those things do occur in our lives a little bit here and there, but in no way should they be a norm. And I think that we've been missing out on the support systems that many of us need to get help for, you know, really tackling our health at the root level and dealing with, really important things to allow us to just live with a little bit more internal freedom.
Yeah. I mean, I think worry, that's something that hits hard home for me as well. Worrying, overthinking, self-doubt. I mean, I feel like it all kind of bundles into the same package, second guessing. And I think we're not alone in that. I feel that it's perhaps something that's always there, but it's how we manage it, right?
That's an interesting word, how we manage it. You know, I used to believe that I was managing it all well because I would be reactive to my worries and overthinking. You know, I would think things a couple of steps ahead and try to mitigate problems that were coming or make longer to-do lists. And I really thought that that was managing. And I think that's part of the problem is that we don't have enough dialogue of what is that healthy way of managing ourselves and our worries look like, because that is one tool. But also, if you're an overthinker and over worrier, for me, I had never heard a term like ruminating thoughts, where I would just spin on a particular worry and look at it from so many different angles. I mean, nobody ever never told me that my to-do lists weren't managing that worry. I was actually praised for being more productive.
Yeah. We don't get taught that at school, actually. We don't get taught any of that.
Yeah. And the reason why I really wanted to create Decoding Anxiety was I found that I'd struggled with my anxiety for so long, and I'd been trying to get help since, my early 20s, at least. You know, I think what I learned through my journey is there's a lot of help needed. You struggle in different groups, you know, but some of the groups that can struggle a lot too are just high functioning individuals. Because when you show up saying, hey, I'm really struggling, like in my situation, people would look at me and say, gosh, you got great good degrees, you have a great job, things look fantastic on paper, right? You just worry too much. And I know Alana's, I know you can relate with from our earlier conversations, but you know, I really believe that that persistence was that inner knowing that now I really think there's something here, you know? I think that intuitive knowing of like, I want to get to the root of this. I knew walking around my body that this could not be normal.
But can I ask though, with, you know, cause on paper people can look, or like even on from the surface level on Instagram or on TV, or, you know, even people that, you know, some people idolize like a celebrity or a singer, it's like, wow, they've got everything. But, you know, some of like the most famous actors will say, I'm not happy. Or is it the anxiety that's there that pushes us to overperform and kind of get to where we think we want to be? Or are we getting to where we want to think where we want to get to, and then therefore the anxiety comes in? What comes first?
That's such a great question. I would say the anxiety comes first because, I mean, anxiety is our body's natural response to a warning signal. I remember I would hear the phrase, anxiety has been around to protect you. It's been there since our caveman days. But that didn't explain, like, but why is it here so persistently? Like, why is it tormenting me? And at the root of it, it does have its purpose, but the wires have been all crossed, right? We are now living in an environment that's completely different than our ancestors lived it in, which means our body is detecting new signals of harm that, you know, as we continue to evolve, we look at the effects of, you know, the systems around us in our lifestyle when symptoms occur. When anxiety becomes, you know, too difficult to deal with.
It takes over. It's a very much, it's something that I feel is not necessarily controllable always, because it does have a place. It does have a self-protective mechanism to it. But when it's constantly there and it's constantly active and it's then hindering the way in which we function, how we sleep, how we interact, how we show up for ourselves, how we show up in our relationships and for work. What do we do when anxiety is present? And I want to say anxiety, but I also want to use the word worrying, overthinking, and all the other synonyms that come with it.
So I do think that we can build a good relationship with our anxiety, where we are managing it in the sense that we are learning to work with it, right? We're learning to understand its cues and its signals and learn how we adapt to it. I don't think it's managing it as in eliminating it, right? Even the best pills that could do that, I don't think we want it to do that, right? Because we could be missing the signal underneath. But, you know, I think part of what was missed and why so many of us suffer with it is we never learned even how to manage our language around anxiety, which can be so ambiguous to many of us, and it can show up differently from one person to the next. You know, it's easy to talk to kids about things like fear and anger. If it's not disturbing you at the time, what's the entryway to start talking about like that subtle, you know, feeling of worry that starts brewing inside of you and how to build a relationship with that early on? You know, I don't have a good solution for that. And I know I didn't start talking with my children about it, even when I knew that language was an important piece. You know, I did try to build more of a vocabulary around the different feelings we were having. But anxiety is a hard one, right? Because it does show up differently with every different person. And so, you know, back to your question about, well, how do we then manage it in a way that helps it work for us instead of against us? Takes that like journey of really building a relationship. And that's why, you know, decoding anxiety is really about decoding your anxiety. You know, it's not a class that you can look at and say, This is what anxiety looks like for every single person, because it's going to show up in your body differently than in my body. But when we talk about the experiences that we have and how that's showing up and where it's actually holding us back from the quality of life that we want to have, then we can look at the sources that are causing those, heightened experiences, and how to work with those sources to just bring the experiences down. You know, paying attention to that experience flaring back up again, because that's a signal, right? Like, you know, that root cause needs to be evaluated again. I can give you one example, which I just completely normalized my experience until I had an experience. It was about when my son was a year old, where this like surge of anxiety had shown up on a Thursday. And I couldn't connect it, you know, and I'd spent a few years at that point trying to like really connect to my body and being able to be more observant of my experiences. And I couldn't like go through my checklist and think of what's causing this. Like everything that I need to do is taken care of. It. Everything is done. Like I'm on top of things. And something just made me curious about the week ahead and the pattern. And it had been my son's birthday. Had a lot of cake and a lot of sweets. And I just had this question of, I wonder if it's related to all that sugar I ate. And I started experimenting with it. And lo and behold, there was my pattern. You know, I started like, I would go into the week clean eating, but Thursday, my sugar consumption would start increasing. And on Friday would start increasing, which led to this feeling of dread and worry. A few days later, like on Sunday evening, it would show up. So for years, I just normalized it as this is a part of working life.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started cutting that sugar out, my Sundays got easier. And Alana, I kid you not, I still remember the feeling of the first Monday that I woke up and I did not have this sensation of dread and worry. Like nothing had changed in my work life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's one of the ways that you start building a relationship with understanding. You know, what's the signal? Like first you have to start with the sensation.
Mm.
And a lot of this is mindfulness and meditation and learning to observe that experience that you're having, and then figure out how to work with the signal it's coming from. But it is ongoing management. I think take that for granted and I start adding a lot of sugar back into my diet, that signal shoots right back up.
Mm-hmm.
I know that feeling of dread at nighttime. I know the worry waking up, and the first thing I go back to is my diet, you know, and start working with the signal again.
It sounds like it's, in essence, we need to start tuning in to our body's cries for help, if we could say that. So it sounds like that anxiety is, and while it is a natural part of our makeup as a human, there are things that exacerbate it. There are things that are going to drive it to have a flare up or inflame, so to say. That's what it sounds like, because unstable blood sugar levels. I mean, we have like, you know, the saying like being hangry, it's also you're hungry and you're angry. That's a feeling, you know, being angry, but it, that being because of your blood sugar levels, it sounds, you know, anxiety is also, I never actually associated the two, that it could. I mean, now that you say it and I think about it, I'm like, oh yeah, that's a very easy connection. But I'd never actually thought about that. And you've had to go through it and experience to then, you've had to go through it and experience it to really then understand what's happening. So there are probably a few different root causes then that come under what is allowing anxiety to kind of rise to the surface. Are there some classics that we need to look out for?
I would say that within lifestyle, there are a few factors. So in Decoding Anxiety, I dive through kind of the heavy hitters, because it would be just near impossible to be able to capture everybody's lived experience of what's triggering the anxiety in their life. But definitely, you know, diet, nutrition, exercise, you know, working with these, the way that what we put in our body can actually be triggering our anxiety is one, definitely one factor, but also the relationships around us and the environment that we're in, environments becoming a norm slowly over time.
Mm-hmm.
So at which point did you look at maybe your interpersonal dynamics and think, gosh, is there something I need to pay attention to here? You know, I think there's a really strong correlation with individuals who haven't learned to have good boundaries for their space and for their needs, who have like porous boundaries, and the way that anxiety shows up in their lives. It takes layers to actually work with your anxiety. And even within one of those pillars, you can go multiple layers in, right? And luckily, you know, once you start working with them, I believe like any layer you start working through, you can start experimenting and feeling relief early on. And that's enough to tell you like, and to motivate you to go deeper into that layer. And that's how it started with boundaries work for me, just understanding like, oh, some of this anxiety is coming from my lack of boundaries. You know, I don't quite know how to protect myself from the demands of others or the needs of others. I don't quite have the language to say, I would love to do that for you, but I'm at capacity. I have nothing to give this week.
I think that's very much learned behavior, isn't it? It's learned behavior or patterns of thought, or just that what you said before, reaction. We're just kind of reacting to situations. And I think until it gets uncomfortable enough, or you're at the point where you're like, I'm a highly anxious person, which is actually also hard to admit, to be like, I'm just a highly anxious person. We don't actively say that. But I feel like until it gets really uncomfortable, where you think, I need to start changing something, I need to change the narrative that's making me feel this way, because this is not sustainable. This is causing me to all the things that, you know, are the symptoms of anxiety. How women are kind of categorized with anxiety, and now as different, you know, as we get older, also like going through perimenopause and menopause, and now different diagnoses coming out as we age. The reason why anxiety has been there, or perhaps the marriage of having a certain diagnosis and then anxiety. So do you want to just talk a little bit more about that as well?
Definitely. Gosh, this is such an important topic for me. I was in my early 20s, though I remember getting my first anxiety attack in high school. I had no language for it. Just that I couldn't breathe. For some reason, I could catch myself breathing. And looking back now, I can see that my body was like so tight and tense. And the symptoms of something going on underneath were there and were really, I think, starting to call out for attention through that first panic attack. Though, through my journey, a lot of what came through as those root signals really came in by chance. And one of those was my own diagnosis with ADHD. For me to get to that diagnosis, I mean, the chance of me being at this certain place at a certain time and to come across this in the way that I did, I thought that this was so strange. What a rare experience. But as I've like continued my journey and been interviewing those that have dealt with anxiety, a lot of experiences are the same, that especially for women, there are so many gaps in what our experiences look like that often we miss the support and the signals that something like ADHD for women, you know, isn't the way that it is in, you know, and even through our healthcare system, we think ADHD is hyperactive little boys, or I shouldn't say all of it, but, you know, there's a stigma that's still associated and it's still in our healthcare system. So that means that when a woman's coming in and, even at a young age is experiencing this distress, anxiety, ADHD, or something that's underlying that anxiety is often not looked at because we're not as well educated within it. So ADHD in women can, the hyperactivity can be internal. That incessant dialogue can be the hyperactivity. Right.
The overthinking. Right. People guessing, the chatter.
Yes, the chatter. Or if it's external, there's that stereotypical girl in class who's just chatting with her friends. And I'm curious how you adapted to it, because I look at some of my early signals and I think people said that was me, so took it on as a personality trait.
So true. That's so funny. I actually, what I heard was I'm chatty in class. I'm distracting others.
I also took that as I have inability to learn properly because I'm always chatting. I'm not learning. I'm not there to learn. I'm there to chat. Very social, you know, and that's, it just made me think that I'm at school to be social and not to learn. And it wasn't until years later after I'd finished and then went back to university as a mature age student that I realized I actually love learning.
Oh, yeah.
Like, why did anyone like, yeah, no, that's really, really nice that you, there's women who are potentially ADHD. And this is an underlying condition for them presenting then with anxiety.
Right. It's an underlying condition. And I won't say just ADHD, but what I've learned is when these issues start presenting themselves, usually those that have more severe versions of, let's say, autism or ADHD, end up getting support early on because the impact is significant. The impact to them in school is significant or in their social environment. So there's usually enough of like some sort of external visibility of an issue that, you know, triggers looking into it deeper. And then I think a label is often attributed at that point in life. But what if you have a mild or moderate version of it? You know, that just looks like chattiness in class on the outside, or that looks like disorganization of paperwork. One of the biggest challenges is in our society when we don't know that the way that our brain functions, you know, really impacts, you know, how we engage with the world. If we don't understand that there can be variances in that and assume that we're all the same, well, then we start categorizing people, right? And we say, well, you're talkative. That's your kid. That's your personality.
Mm-hmm.
You're disorganized. That's just part of your personality. And we start this whole cycle. But if we better understood that, actually, when you look at maybe a pattern of excessive chattiness and other behavior trends that show a pattern of ADHD, there's a better ability to understand, like, hey, your way of engaging with the world looks really similar to those who, you know, have ADHD, and it's really it's a label because that's what we use to describe it. But it's really, you just function differently,
yeah.
Right? And if you can figure out how to function best, great. You make that work for you. We can work on your functioning, right? Because this is the way that your school system is built, or your work environment, or, you know, because you're a working mom with kids who have to be at school at a certain time. We can work with that to make it, you know, to bring in support or tools or skill building to make that work for you.
So this is why you said at the start, you're like listening like to your body. Like, well, you kind of said, you didn't say that exactly, but you said the importance of like understanding how to work with your body and go like in a holistic way to be able to, you know, look after yourself. You basically said, so I think it's a very inward out approach instead of, because, you know, often it's like you have anxiety or ADHD or like, let's just diagnose you. And then, you know, and then, you know, you kind of go, but if you start to perhaps realize the patterns that are within you, then you understand how you work. And then you can kind of from an inward outward way, perhaps navigate the world a little bit better.
I love what you just said. I just love it because you're right. It's an inward outward experience in how you navigate the world. But how do you identify what might be different inwards? And I think the patterns are external. You can look at the external patterns that are showing up in how you're engaging with the world. The overthinking, right? Overthinking. It showed up in conversations. It showed up in the massive to-do lists. It showed up in meetings where I was trying to think through, like, what about this situation? What about this thinking? And I would say that it was the overthinking and the chronic worrying.
Mm.
And not being able to just even simply pause and reflect on, is this really a worry that even needs discussion? Because it was all just so jumbled together. Patterns were obvious to others, you know, when they tell us you worry too much. And then, you know, if you take that external pattern and think, do I worry too much? What is too much? Right. But I think that does give you a dialogue and be like, gosh, my brain is just never quiet. I didn't know that people existed that had silence in their heads. My brain is never quiet.
I think so many women can relate to that.
Yeah.
I mean, even just trying to get to sleep in that monkey mind. So many women, I should say, but my son at the age of 3, he's like trying to get to sleep. He's like, Mom, the monkey on my shoulder won't stop talking. That's what he said to me.
What an amazing way to teach him at a young age to like watch that monkey mind.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know what to say, but we still talk about it sometimes. I'm like, is that monkey still there? He's like, oh yeah, sometimes. But yes, giving a name to it and knowing and just acknowledging it. You also spoke about like the right language around this chatter, this worry, this, is this me? How can we talk to ourselves about this? You talk about decoding and you talk about, you know, living with it. It's not going to go away. But how can we then perhaps embrace it as a superpower and then live with it?
The first time I heard, at least with anxiety, somebody told me your anxiety won't go away, but you'll learn to manage it. I thought, I don't want this life where I'm like constantly managing something. Like it just felt so defeating, you know? And so I just want to paint a different picture that's not what managing all of this. But I think managing all of this really looks like having a better understanding of yourself and your needs and not necessarily having the answers to everything, but at least having that agency and validation to think, hey, there's something in my experience here that's holding me back from my goals. Whether it's a change in your diet, whether it's getting a label like a, you know, mild neurodiversity, or whether it's just understanding that it seems like when people give verbal instructions to a lot of folks, they're able to remember it and retain it. I really struggle with that. You know, just even understanding that little part of your brain, your working memory, could use a little bit of strengthening, you know, could use a little bit of attention.
And perhaps also the non-judgment there.
Yeah. Oh,
I struggle with that. Not because I'm any less or they're different or they're better, but just I struggle with that. And that's okay. Let's learn with it. Let's get curious.
Yeah.
Let's figure out how we can better support ourselves in a situation like that. Do we need a voice recorder? Or, you know, like, do we need something then to write it down when we're listening?
Right.
Exactly. I love that.
And that's a big part of the mission of Beyond the Mind company that I started, which was really founded by within the AI for Good Institute in partnership with Stanford University. So part of the Institute mission is for this new chapter in Tech Wave, how do we use AI for positive societal impact? When I applied to the AI for Good Institute, I had a hypothesis that I think that a lot of the technology that, you know, can be used to better understand our patterns and the way that our brain work is more accessible for us in this new wave of AI than it ever was before. And so we're looking to use that technology to basically give individuals the agency. Like, I don't want anyone to have to rely on their doctor or their therapist to decide, like, yeah, you look like you fall enough into this pattern to start understanding more about how your brain works. Mm-hmm. It has such a significant impact in how we navigate our day-to-day and even our relationships, right? What if you could even say, hey, I know I have, labels aside, I know I have some impulsive patterns when it comes to things that I'm excited about. So I might interrupt you while we're talking. Just know I don't mean to. I don't mean to be rude. It's just such a natural inclination and I'm working on it because I really want to hear what you're saying. Gosh, how much differently does that affect our dynamic?
Yeah. And just the information and also the awareness that is how it's going to be. And then honestly, just like relaying that to someone, it makes the conversation open and just Like it would be less aggressive if someone's trying to say something and the other person's just constantly coming in.
Right. And so less aggressive, right? So like for the speaker in that instance, it feels aggressive. Somebody's interrupting them and they might develop this judgment of how rude, gosh, how insensitive, right? Now we've labeled this person, we've critiqued them. Maybe the way that we show up in our interactions with them now is like keeping them at a distance or shaming them or cutting them off of like, oh, you always interrupt me. You're so rude. You know, the other individual, and this is a pattern of ADHD, frequent interrupting. I might not realize, what am I doing wrong? I just don't know. Mm-hmm. I just did what came naturally to me. Mm-hmm. And I was so into their conversation. I was so excited about it. I thought I was being respectful. How do you decipher all of that? And I don't think we even need that label of saying, this is what the reason is. I think even understanding ourselves to say, I have some impulsivity patterns. Mm-hmm. They can show up in areas where I'm really excited.
Yeah.
It's hard to contain my excitement. So if I interrupt you, just know it's out of excitement, but I'll try not to do so.
This is so nice. I feel like not only for people who experience anxiety, I feel like this would be beneficial for everybody, actually, if everyone could have these types of conversations. But first, before you can even do that, one needs to have the self-awareness. One needs to understand themselves and kind of have done that work first. One thing that I'm kind of thinking about as you're relaying this is, you know, life is so broad blanket. And when we have anxiety, and if there is perhaps, you know, ADHD or anything behind it, there are so many triggers in life. And if you don't know where to start, like with the awareness of where it is,
right.
It's like, you know, it's working on the self, but it's actually, you have to just kind of take it, like start a complete life change is what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. It's really in every area of your life. Like you can kind of start by unturning any stone. Like what you said before, there's layers in. So in each pillar, there's so many different layers. You can kind of just start anywhere, any trigger that comes and just start feeling into it.
And that can be overwhelming. That can be so overwhelming. At least for me, before I had any real tools, it was so overwhelming that I didn't know what to do. I knew that there was like, your meditation was good, positive thinking was good, but toxic positivity was bad. Yeah. I should work on my breath, but also exercise and also work on my diet. I mean, there's just so much. I really struggled with, but why, right? Like a lot of advice I think was thrown around, especially for dealing with anxiety. And I could, without understanding, well, why is this important? I never knew what to reach for and when. And that is the premise behind decoding anxiety. For many of us, we really need to understand why, right? In order to really prioritize it. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of us where, I think we've taught that book knowledge is of highest intellect, but our body's knowledge is to be dismissed. You really need to understand why deep breathing helps tell our nervous system that we're safe, right? And that it is a powerful tool and that you can use it. No, it's not going to solve all of your anxiety problems, but it's a tool you can reach for, just the same way that when you have a cold, sometimes you reach for the Kleenex and sometimes you might, reach for the lemon tea. Sometimes you might reach for something from your, medicine cabinet. And sometimes you just need a day off to rest.
Yeah.
Like there's different things that you reach for depending on the way that you're experiencing it in your body. So this part of decoding anxiety, one thing that was really important for me was to take away that overwhelm of, oh my gosh, what do I even start with? And what's most important to me? And what's going to have like the biggest impact in taking down this discomfort to the highest level that it's at. And so there's a lot that we've incorporated in the program that balances education about mind and body with practical exercises. And like you said, it takes self-reflection. So, formatting reflective questions in a way that can work for somebody who's still new to mm-hmm. working with themselves in this way.
Yeah.
Because it's a relationship. Really. You can't just jump right in and think, hey, body, I haven't asked you for 20 years. Like, what do you need right now? And expect to get an answer right away, right? It takes time to learn and engage and build that relationship again with yourself.
Mm. And also differentiate between what's perhaps like a childhood wound and what's rational, right?
Yes.
I think there's like a big defense mechanism that comes in. It's like, you're fine. What are you doing? Like, we're good, or whatever it is, you know, like, yeah, some of the old wounds don't want to be touched. And I think anxiety also does like a very good job at kind of keeping you safe from going into those areas of your life too, but they are important.
Definitely. And I think a lot of that healing, you know, happens in the right, within the right support system. So finding the right therapist, the right community, finding community around you and determining, you know, which are the friends and family members that I can really relate to in this dialogue?
Yeah.
Who maybe has a different experience and just can't relate? Like, I'm trying to decipher what the next step is with where I'm stuck. Is it a wound? You know, is it a big wound? Is it a small wound? Like, how do I navigate that? Right. And it does take, I think, some skilled support.
Yeah.
And what I found was that sometimes that can be really hard to find. And especially if you're struggling already with your health, with anxiety, to go and navigate finding the best support for you, to figure out like who takes your insurance, to figure out if personalities types match, that alone is exhausting. Mm-hmm. And then to sit down in front of somebody like a therapist and to reshare like this painful journey you might have been on or what your recent struggles are, to relive all that, it's exhausting too. Yeah. And it's so exhausting that it'll often prevent many people from taking the steps to get the right support.
To even start.
And so that's where decoding anxiety is meant to be a complement to therapy and also a bridge, right? So that individuals don't have to get worse, but they have support while they're building their support system. Because unfortunately, from you know all the interviews that I've done, the pattern, whether it's about getting support for the anxiety or getting diagnosed with a learning disability or understanding that even if something as simple as like, gosh, my working memory is really poor, like yeah. I don't want it to be.
Yeah.
Usually the catalyst for that takes some sort of detrimental impact.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Having your boss be upset with you because they think you're not paying attention in the meeting because you can't remember what was said. And you're like, I was there. What happened? It just slipped my brain.
And then not allowing that to also, as you said, define who you are, define your self-worth. Right. You know, all of the stories that we tell ourselves, it's almost hindering all of that side of the detrimental effects that we have.
Yeah.
By like honoring and like understanding ourselves. Yeah. Being confident with that as well, like being okay with how we function in this world. Mm.
Yeah. And for those that have gone, I really believe that the longer the individuals have gone without understanding themselves, without understanding how they work, without having some tools to advocate for themselves, the more harm is done, right? The more they take on the blame from others, the more they take on the shaming from others. You know, the more that when a teacher says, you don't seem to be paying attention, everybody else in this class is paying attention to what's wrong with you. You think, what's wrong?
Yeah. That narrative starts and it doesn't stop actually until you actively choose that it stops now.
Yeah.
That's the thing, because then it's, you know, like you're looking, yeah, you're thinking to have a child, you start seeing prams everywhere. You're wanting to buy a red car. There's all of a sudden red cars right. everywhere. When you're told this, just because of the way that you are this type of person throughout your life, you're just constantly reminded of this until you just identify with that, whether it's true or not.
Right.
So it's really actually really powerful work that you do. Decoding anxiety is one way to help unravel this. You teach the tools to help support this. The second project that you're doing with Beyond the Mind.
Yes. with Beyond the Mind. So Decoding Anxiety is a course that's offered as part of the company to Beyond the Mind.
Mm-hmm.
As we focus on educational content as one pillar. But a lot of our work right now is taking advantage of, you know, the new technology wave and helping give agency and advocacy back to individuals. Because like you said, once you can even just stop, once you can give yourself permission to say, this isn't a character flaw of mine. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's even something like, there's something different here. And you know what? I really like that about myself. It's not even something that needs to be fixed. It's not something that I need to work on. It's different. There's a lot with neurodiversities. You can see the world is just not built for all different types of individuals, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's more support systems that are coming up around. I read recently that there are retail stores that have hours just meant for those that have like sensory sensitivities, you know, so they like dim the lights and they, you know, are just create a much more calming environment. But
that's amazing.
How amazing, right? And then as an individual to just be able to say, it's not something I'm going to apologize for. This is actually what my body needs. And how great that there's a store that accommodates this. I'm going to go support that store. I want more like this. I want to, you know, I want to recommend that other stores that I shop at, like, look at this model. Like, to be able to just like advocate for yourself and for others and your unique needs, I think is really, really empowering. So it's funny, Alana, because we talked about, you know, how a lot of these differences go missed in women. And what's interesting is with some of the misdiagnoses. So Dr. Halliwell, who's an expert in ADHD, has spoken about this on a couple podcasts. But, you know, many, many underserved communities are likely struggling with an underdiagnosis, meaning maybe they have been diagnosed with something like ADHD, but they don't know that they also have an autism,
mm-hmm.
You know, that they're somewhere on the autism spectrum, or maybe they have PTSD and they don't know that they have ADHD, you know, so they're getting one tiny like input of what they can work with, a knowledge of themselves, but it goes years until they can get more. But you know, gap can be significant. So underdiagnosis and completely misdiagnosis affects most underserved communities. So women is definitely one. I think there's a lot of work too. You know, we are starting to build the tools that have been gaps up until today, and you know, really are trying to utilize this new chapter of more affordable and available technology to help support individuals, but are definitely also looking for more partners that are already working in this space, because you can see the problem scope is pretty broad in terms of the individuals that it impacts. And there's already amazing communities that are doing work in this space. And so just as we talked about that individual that is struggling, it takes a lot in their journey. First, they need to, you know, better understand themselves. And as part of the advocating for themselves, find that right community support system. So we want to make that easier for individuals than it is today. And today, I mean, it's quite complex. Individuals can go their whole lifetime. I mean, there's people that are just now getting diagnosed in their 60s and saying, you know, dealing with the grief of like, I didn't understand that this was the difference in me. I blamed myself so much. I missed out on so much. You know, that's a lot of grief. So it can really, you know, save individuals decades, decades of struggling.
Yeah. Like just for everyone who doesn't fit in to that cookie cutter mold of normal, you know, it's because I think everyone also like no one like what is normal? That's the question, you know, everyone. And I think for me, this is kind of the take home is that everyone has differences about them, and we can't change the world, although it does sound amazing that shops are changing for different types of things. But if we can start to understand ourselves a bit better, we can also just get on in the world better, as you explained, talking to people properly, managing, I don't want to say that, but just understanding that I need to not do this today. I need to rest today. I need, you know, understanding what you need to do in the world or what you need to do in your life to make it a bit easier for yourself. And I think that's really beautiful.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's once you understand that that's your need and can get the right support systems for yourself within the day, everything's just become so much easier. You know, I know we were chatting before the show about a family member that I'm supporting with their health journey, but even just understanding that I'm not going to depend on my working memory for this, you know, and going into the doctor's appointments and being like, if you don't mind, I'm going to record this conversation so I can just refer back to it later. Like, it's huge permission, right? I can explain to them. It's just for myself. I don't want to be taking notes and trying to concentrate on you. My brain is going to get overwhelmed. So I'm just going to record.
That knowledge, that self-awareness, it's actually the self-awareness. That's the thing. Having that self-awareness allows it all to be easier.
Yeah.
Instead of just that constant struggle of no one else is recording or no one else is doing this, why should I? But just having the self-awareness to know this is how I am, and that's great. And embrace it.
The self-validation, right? And it's okay. I have this.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong. Just my eye. This is what I need.
Yes. It's so nice. Yeah. Cedra, so I want to ask like one last question for you. What do you think to be true, which perhaps our scientific community has not yet proven when it comes to everything that we're talking about? Is there something which you're kind of waiting for the research to catch up to say, yes, of course?
Such a good question.
Because I think, you know, when we get diagnosed or when we kind of pigeonhole, you know, all these different conditions, it makes, I don't know, I feel like it's almost taking away from going back in. So I don't know. I just wondered, perhaps you know something to be true where you're like, this is how it is. We just don't know it yet, or no one's proved it yet.
That's what I've learned from my journey. And I wouldn't say that no one's proved it yet, but I think it's still a battle. You know, I often dismiss my own emotional needs or my own needs for boundaries. I think women, we do that because we're taught to be nice and accommodating and to be likable. There's so much within that I know there's already so much active dialogue. I think it's really difficult when in certain communities to really give the weight to how much like your emotional experience impacts your health, right? It impacts your quality of life. It impacts your career trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
Impacts your ability to take risks. You know, what I found it beyond the mind, I got to reflect back on who I was before I started this journey. And I would have listened to all the naysayers, or, you know, what I've learned is often there's others that have their fear and they project that onto you, right? And we all have a different fear tolerance
mm-hmm.
as well. So just learning that, gosh, in this particular area, I'm actually not that scared. I'm actually really confident that there's important work to do here and that we're going to be able to help a lot of people. You know, and I'm confident that the business numbers and everything will work its way, because I'm confident that I've built the right communities around the company support and the communities that I've been in and have gotten like so many different perspectives and brains on the table. You know, I think that that's the beauty of like understanding yourself and your limitations, but also having this ability to manage your anxiety instead of having it manage how you are engaging and showing up and the way that you're looking at opportunities. Because when I started out my career, you know, it really, my anxiety created this avoidant behavior where it's like, I wanted the challenge, but I avoided the challenge. I wanted the challenge, but I avoided the challenge. You know, and I just could not figure out what was wrong with me. Like, why am I doing that? I think there's so much that can still be done, because these things about, you know, like, how do you quantify the emotional impact, right? It takes time to get like the metrics and the numbers that the scientific community, the engineering community, you know, can really say, yes, I believe that how much your experience can shift and change. And this is the monetary value that can result from it. I think it's how do we measure success? You know, that.
Yeah. Changes everything actually.
Yeah.
And just for, yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a huge topic in itself, the way in which we measure success as women who are highly functioning, overthinkers, overwarriors. Yeah. And yeah, how that basically can really just shape who we are. I often think that I need to redefine what success is. And I think in the end, it's, yeah, liking yourself, what you do and how you do it.
And I've struggled with this with Beyond the Mind is, okay, well, what metrics do I put to the quality of life improvement when somebody understands and can start dealing with trauma or, you know, that misdiagnosis of being somewhere on the autism spectrum? Like, if people are just being diagnosed in adulthood, how do we quantify what was missed in their past? Right? In a way that fits into the metrics that are being used to be comparable to something like ad sales or even something still in the health field, right? Like, there's so much important work to be done. And some of that work has started a while back. So we might have quantifiable numbers for investing in breast cancer research. But you know, there's a newness and a vagueness to this that I'm sure somebody somewhere is using some great numbers. If not, I trust that I'm in the right circles, that, you know, we're actually, AI for Good Institute is all about this, like, how do we measure the positive societal impact in different metrics than the traditional revenue generating impact? And you can still achieve both, right?
Yeah, wonderful. I think your work and what you're doing and how you do it is very needed. Like, it's very apt. And also the fact that you're using kind of AI to also delve into this, I think, yeah, I feel like it's a space that needs to be watched.
Appreciate that.
Yeah.
I appreciate having the time to come here and chat with you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being here.
I appreciate it. I so look forward to continuing the connections and the conversations.
Thanks so much for being here. You could have been listening to anything, but you're here interested in reclaiming your health. I hope you found the episode useful and constructive. If you enjoyed it and would like to show support for the show, please leave a review, as this makes my content more discoverable for other people to enjoy and learn from. Please also consider subscribing to the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you enjoy listening. Finally, the best way to show support for the show is by sharing it with someone who you think might benefit from it. Thanks for listening. Be well, and I'll catch you next time.